So in the memos, a handful of you asked about the concept of religiosity, and I thought that'd be a good thing to start with. Religiosity is the degree to which a person practices their religion or sort of how devout they are. And if you're going to create a measure of religiosity, what categories or characteristics would you ask about? So traditionally what's asked is, what's your religion? And the person identifies what the religious tradition is. But if we really want to know, you know, well, if you are Muslim, how devout of a Muslim are, what's your level of religiosity, or any religion, whatever the religion is, how would you measure person's devoutness or religiosity? So what questions would you ask them on a survey?
How many hours a week do you spend thinking about it?
Okay. So contemplation. What other things?
How many times a week do you actually practice the religion in, like, the place of worship?
Okay, so worship service attendance. You're pretty ambitious in saying how many times a week. I would probably say how many times in a year, but...
Yeah, I mean, I guess. It's true.
What other characteristics?
Like, if you volunteer at all in
okay.
an organization.
Like a faith-based volunteering? Mm-hmm. Okay. What other things would you put on?
Yeah. How many percentage of your friends are, like, of the same religion?
Okay, yeah. So your friendship network.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Any other things? Could we say, how much money do you give to the religion?
Money. How long it's, like, been a tradition in your family?
Okay, so how many generations? How often do you pray? How often do you read the religious text or scripture of your religion? So in a sense, you covered a lot of them. And if we asked a question like this to everyone, we could get a much better sense of the range of religiosity versus just asking what's your religion and the person says Christian. A large percentage of the U.S. population would identify as Christian. But then if you ask these questions, like what proportion of your friends identify as Christian, do you pray? How often do you do faith-based volunteering? How much money do you give in a year? That would give some signal of the level of religiosity or how devout a person is. Some of you asked the question about secularization and what is that. And secularization is related to this, and it's related to the larger picture of religion in society and in the workplace. And the basic theory of secularization was that as societies or countries become more developed and more modern, religion will disappear, or the presence of religion will become diminished. And it's the idea was that as we become more enlightened, the things of religion, like sort of the superstition or the belief in the supernatural, will subside. And a lot of it was based on looking at the countries in Europe, where Europe was part of the Enlightenment Revolution, and a byproduct of that was that religion was on the decline. The problem with secularization theory was the stubborn persistence of religion in the U.S. So religion has continued to be a dominant presence in the U.S., much more so than in Europe. And yet the U.S. is one of the most developed, advanced countries in the world. And so then the question is, how can a society that's so advanced and so developed still believe in religion and pursue religion and believe in the supernatural? Like, it basically undermined the whole secularization theory. And then this alternative way of looking at secularization theory, which I actually feel gives a much better picture of it. And so rather than secularization being a decline in religion, like a disappearing of religion, described as a decline in religious authority. So if you think about this in your own life, that how much authority does religion or religious teachings have in your life? And you can look at it both at an individual level and at a societal or institutional level. So let's say 150 years ago, religion had much greater authority in society. Like, people at the top of the social hierarchy, or the people who were the wisest ones in the community, the ones that you went to for advice, was the local priest or minister. They were sort of the authority. Now it's the business executives or other people in the market economy who are sort of the ones that we go to for insight or advice. But 150 years ago, and even before then, it was the priest or the pastor who was the authority. And if you think in your own life, your own trajectory, there might have been a season where you saw yourself as a very faith-filled person, where, you know, whatever the scripture said, you took it to heart and you aligned your life based on the authority of the religious teachings. But then as time went on, you sort of said, well, I see that stuff, but I'm not going to sort of submit to that authority. I'm going to submit to some other authority. And so what's happening, even in the U.S., even though the U.S. is tremendously religious, the prominence of religious authority has significantly diminished. And even we see it in ways of, like, when the Supreme Court take the Ten Commandments out of the courtroom, or other tactile ways of removing religion or religious authority from institutions is a way of displaying that religion no longer has the place of authority that it used to. So at an institutional level, but then also at an individual level. And for me, a natural byproduct of that is, especially at the individual level, if you had a life that was founded on basically submitting to religious authority, and not necessarily a religious person, but the religious teachings, if you're no longer submitting yourself to that authority, what new authority are you submitting to? Are you submitting to the authority of the media? Are you submitting to the authority of the market? Are you submitting to the authority of your parents? You know, what is, you know, it's just a natural question to ask, because you always are submitting to some authority. If you're only submitting to your own authority, that doesn't necessarily work, because you're being informed and sort of following some path. So this whole idea of secularization, rather than is religion increasing or decreasing or staying the same, it's more, what is the authority that people in societies are submitting to as they make decisions? So that gives a bit of a sense of what religiosity is and what secularization is. And even it could bring into question these ways of measuring religiosity. Because a person can go to church every Sunday, a person can pray every day, a person can give money, and yet still not be submitting to the authority of their particular religion. So they're going through the motions, and yet it's not informing or transforming their personal life. My question for you all is, since coming to Indiana, since coming to IU, to what extent has your religious devoutness increased or decreased or remained the same? So everyone is sort of on this religious journey. Even if you're non-religious, that's part of the journey. Has your religious practices or your religious life increased since coming to IU? Or has it decreased? Or has it remained the same? So, and we're going to do a stand-up exercise just to get a sense of people's, where they're at in their religious journey, because this will influence sort of your journey post-IU. So since coming to IU, your religiosity has increased, come down to this end. If since coming to IU, your religious practices and beliefs have decreased, go to that end. And if it stayed the same, you get to be in the middle. So for the people where your religious practices have decreased, what are some of the things that you would attribute to why that's been the case? Yeah.
I would say, for me at least, you know, when I came to college, obviously Saturday nights is a pretty big night.
Uh-huh.
Waking up Sunday morning was just not always top of my list.
Uh-huh.
So not really like my, you know, outlooks have decreased.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, my attendance to church and other, you know, events like that have really gone down just because have other priorities, I guess.
Sure. And so if a church had service on Sunday night, it might change the whole story.
Yeah, probably.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Other people, were you just saying, yes?
I went to Catholic school, grade school, all the way to high school, so coming here was kind of a relief. I got my fill church back in grade school, but every time I go home, I still go with my mom.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think one of the driving forces to go to church was going with family.
Okay. And when they're removed from the immediate picture,
I still haven't lost, like, my faith or anything. It's just a little freedom.
Sure. When you've made up for it, you logged a number of church service attendances during the early part of your life that you can.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. Other people, things that have caused your religiosity to decrease since coming to IU? Or even, has it been a thing where since coming to IU, you realize, I don't believe this stuff? You know, both of you had shared to the extent that your religious practices have decreased, but your religious belief has remained. But for other people, coming to college is clearly a time when religious belief changes. Yeah.
I've had my doubts at times, actually, because I've met a lot of people that kind of, like, put thoughts in your head, and they show me, like, some articles about studies. I can't really think of anything off the top of my head, but it kind of got me thinking, but then going home is just, like, reiterates everything.
Hmm. So it's been tested or challenged, but it's also withstood.
Exactly. There's, like, a bunch of debates and stuff about religion.
For the people who have seen their religious practices increase, what have you attributed that to?
I have just some friends who are Catholic, and I go with them to church. My dad was raised Catholic, but we never really went to church, so now I go with that. I tend to go with them a few, every other week, usually, for services, so it's a big increase for me. I never used to go.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to the friendship network.
Right.
Like, in a sense, you found yourself around people who attended church, and so then...
You tend to go then.
Yeah, then you go.
Yeah.
Whereas if your social network doesn't value religion or religious practices, then you'd be overcoming hurdles to make that happen. Other people? Yeah.
I was, like, kind of trying to be more in the middle, but I mean, I would say, like, my religiosity is, like, kind of increased a little bit just because, I mean, back in, like, middle school, high school, I didn't really, like, talk about religion too much with my friends. I didn't think too much about it, but just now, I mean, I've seen, like, people, like, talk about, I mean, going to church and, like, school organizations here and stuff like that, and just kind of, like, drawing strength from it. So, I mean, it's just, I don't know, nice to see it from, like, their perspective and, like, how they draw from it.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. Okay, we can go back to our seats. Part of the reason why I think it's important to even do an exercise like this is that so often religion is just very taboo. Like, you just don't talk about religion. Or as you were saying, it ends up in these big debates about things that really you can't come to a conclusive answer about. And so then you just end up not talking about religion. But yet, for a lot of people, their religion is a significant part of their life. Whether they're devout people or they're people who are fiercely opposed to religion. Like, it's a very charged topic for a lot of people, and for both sides. So if you're very devout, then, you know, religion is important to you and it informs the decisions that you make. Or if you're opposed to religion, you have some very strong beliefs of why religion can be harmful or hurtful. And my perspective is that it's value to engage and talk about religion, whereas if you don't, then it just reinforces these stereotypes or misperceptions that we would have. And so even just simply knowing a person's faith journey or religious journey is helpful. And knowing whether religion has been increasing in their life or decreasing, it's a part of that person's story and journey. And to ignore it or to not talk about it doesn't help with understanding each other. An interesting thing, you know, we talked Tuesday a lot about the uniqueness of religion in America, and I think it's helpful to think about religion around the world. And one of the concepts that in the U.S. was avoided was this idea of a state religion, where the state dictates this is going to be the official religion of the state and of the country, and everyone who's a citizen must be of that religion. And so the most probably significant example was the Roman Empire, when Constantine said, establish Christianity as the state religion. And basically, that became the official religion. And some would say that that actually hurt Christianity as a religion when it was mandated and forced on people versus voluntarily chosen. But it actually became a common practice that you have certain states that would say, countries that would say Catholicism is the official state religion, or different societies, different branches of Protestantism would be the state religion. And so then you had this history of people in communities or localities who were Catholic because the leader was Catholic and declared a Catholic state, but then a war broke out and a new leader came in who was Protestant, and so then the people would have to convert to Protestantism, And so there's just this sort of swinging back and forth where it became a very highly politicized aspect versus a personal pursuit. And you also have the Crusades. So it wasn't just within Christianity, but then you have Christian rulers taking over Muslim countries and declaring them to be Christian, and a lot of bloodshed occurred as a result of that with the Crusades, and you have things like the Inquisition. So throughout history, the combining of church and state, or the politicization of religion, led to a lot of death and led to undermining, sort of, I'll say, the spirit of religious pursuits. And even in contemporary society, we have like the Soviet Union, where for multiple generations, two or three generations, for a large swath of the world, religion was outlawed. So under the Soviet Union and under communist rule, one of the core principles is that there is no God, and that religion and religious practices and submitting to religious authority is outlawed. And so if you think of people, not only in Russia, but all the countries in the Soviet Union, a lot of whom were either Russian Orthodox or Muslim or other faith traditions, basically all of the places of worship were shut down, were closed, and people were banned from going there. Not only going to it in a corporate setting, but also individual practice of it was more or less banned. And so it's fascinating for me when you take an entire society and you basically say, no religion. What was interesting, though, with the fall of the Soviet Union was a lot of bubbling up of religious leaders in fighting against the Soviet Union. So in Poland and other countries where they overthrew the communist rule, a lot of it was driven by religious social movements. And even in today, in China, religion is technically outlawed as well, or at least anything outside of the officially sanctioned churches. So in China, if you want to run a church, you need to be listed on a registry of officially accepted churches, and every other church that exists is operating illegally. But what's happening in China is fascinating. You have all these underground churches that are under the radar, that are home churches, that are sort of done in secret, and religion is actually thriving in China, even though officially, legally, you can't practice formal religion in China. So if we think about the context of the U.S. being very unique and that there's tremendous religious freedom, it's not necessarily always going to lead to greater religiosity. It's actually in places where it's suppressed or persecuted that religion thrives. But I think it is helpful to kind of know that what we have in the U.S. is unique, and that in other parts of the world, it's very different. Another interesting thing is in a lot of countries in Africa, where it's Christian nations, they tend to be much, much more conservative than the churches in the U.S. or Europe. And so you have the Episcopal Church in the U.S., and its sister affiliate is the Anglican Church. And the Anglican Church in many countries in Africa is very, very conservative in their outlook. And so the Episcopal Church here is open to homosexuals, but the Anglican Church in most parts of the world is opposed to homosexuality. And so then, you know, religion doesn't know state borders or country boundaries. And so if you're a leader of a religious organization and half of your constituents are pro-homosexuality and the other ones in other countries are opposed to it, what do? Do you sort of impose your religious beliefs on the people in different countries in Africa to say, oh, you need to get on board and be open and accepting to homosexuals? Or do you let them run their course? Do you let them self-govern how they're going to run their religion? So it's, you know, we think in the U.S. it's complicated, but then if you look at a global scale, it's even more complicated. But I want to bring this back to the U.S. and in the workplace. And we have a great example in Indiana with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and its implications for Indiana. And we're going to look at a video that goes in and explains it from the religious perspective, whereas 2 weeks ago we looked at it from the perspective of sexual orientation. Now we're going to look at it from the perspective of religious organizations.
Indiana is currently in the midst of a national uproar over its Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Major state politicians, LGBT groups, and tech companies have all spoken out against the bill, saying that it will lead to discriminations against gays and lesbians in the name of religion. So what's going on? how much religious freedom do we have in the United States, and does this bill protect that, or is it just discriminatory? So, First Amendment things first. American citizens are guaranteed freedom of religion, expression, assembly, and the right to petition. That is at the core of this entire country's political system. But over the years, asterisks have been added to this principle, like you don't have the freedom to yell fire in a crowded theater. And in terms of religious freedom, after a landmark 1878 Supreme Court case, the Chief Justice declared that you can't express your religion at the cost of social duties and good order. Okay, so human sacrifices are out, but what about refusing to work on Saturdays because it's against your religion? Or choosing to withdraw your children from school due to religious conflicts? A number of Supreme Court cases in the last century focused on narrowing that gray area of legally acceptable religious freedoms. Many cases hinged on something called compelling interest. This means that if the government doesn't have a strong constitutional reason to protect the public's interests, then any interference in individuals' religious practices could be deemed unconstitutional. The 1993 Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act reflected this sentiment. It was passed following two lawsuits publicly considered to unnecessarily violate the religious rights of Native Americans. It said that even though a law is religiously neutral, it can still have a negative effect or burden on religious practices. So the RFRA clarified that a law may only constitutionally burden one's religious practices when doing so both advances a compelling government interest and there is no less restrictive way to do so. However, the law did provide legal standing for unintended forms of discrimination. Take, for instance, the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court case from 2014, wherein a company refused to offer their employees birth control on religious grounds. Based on their argument that corporations can be considered people due to an earlier Supreme Court ruling, the government wasn't allowed to significantly burden the company's religious practices and then upheld the refusal. Similarly, Indiana's recent passage of their own Religious Freedom Restoration Act has been especially incendiary for the fear that it could allow businesses the right to discriminate against gay people in the face of a looming landmark Supreme Court decision regarding same-sex marriage. So, let's get down to it. Is Indiana's new Religious Freedom Act discriminatory? Experts say, yes, it is. In its current form, the law could be used to discriminate on the basis of religious freedom.
That perspective is one perspective. It's still being debated because if you look at the original intent of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act on a federal level, it was put in place to protect people's religious freedoms. But as we see, it's very complicated and it almost has to be handled case by case. I think the best way to conceptualize it is at two levels. One is someone's religion, and this is all in the context of the workplace, is someone's religion or practice of their religion being impeded? In the sense, are they being inhibited from practicing their religion in some significant way? And then the other flip side of it is someone being imposed upon by religion? So it's that narrow line of a person being able to practice the religion without being impeded, but also a person to be able to be in the workplace without being imposed upon in the religion. And it's somewhat subjective where you would draw that line. But some of the ways in which it manifests itself, like probably the most practical example is with regard to clothing. So certain religions have edicts of the type of clothing that one is supposed to wear. So you think of Sikhs who have the head garment, and this came up a case with the military that someone who is Sikh, a practicing Sikh, couldn't wear the military, U.S. military uniform in its current form because of their headscarf. And so then the question was the requirement to wear the military uniform impeding that person from practicing their religion? And so, you know, and it also would come up in other workplaces like women who wear a hijab. There's certain industries where they would say, oh, you can't wear that if you're going to be a customer service representative. If you're going to be a frontline person, we don't want you wearing that. And she would say, well, why not? And if they don't have a compelling reason, and that's where it's this compelling interest, like if there's something compelling, if there is no compelling interest to protect the safety of the public, then you should allow the religious practice to continue on. So with Sikhs, another one is part of the thing is to carry a sword or a dagger. Now, then on there came up in the airport when the person who had to seek, you know, the full garment on and had the dagger, it was not allowed because there was compelling interest that that would be a threat to the safety of the public. Not necessarily that the Sikh person was going to use the sword or the dagger, but that to have that in the presence on an airplane was compelling enough reason that it could threaten the safety of the public. But other things would be religious holidays. Should you make accommodations for people to have a day off for a religious holiday or religious practices? Also, religious beliefs. The example of a person put in their cubicle or in their office statements, Bible verses or other statements about their religious beliefs. So it's the question in the workplace basically comes down to the workplace has an obligation to make reasonable accommodations to the employees to freely exercise their religion without impediments. On the flip side, the workplace or organization is not required to do something that's going to cause undue hardships to the organization. So again, it's that same, the dance between impeding religion versus imposing religion in the workplace. A thing that I find interesting in the U.S., and that you don't necessarily know about, but it bubbles up every so often, is that the number of organizations in the U.S. that are owned, that are faith-based private sector organizations. So one, it isn't the private sector, it's a nonprofit, is the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association. So it started as a Christian faith-based nonprofit, but now recently they actually completely rebranded themselves to where they are called the Y. So they've dropped the men's and the Christians part of it to signal that they're more inclusive of an organization. But if you go to different parts of the country, some YMCA organizations are very, very religiously oriented, and other ones are completely secular. And then in the private sector, you have organizations like Chick-fil-A, where it's very clear, unambiguous about their faith is central to the operations of their organization, such that they don't operate on Sundays. And part of that is the belief that they don't want to impede their employees from going to worship on Sunday. So not only does the owner want to be free to worship on Sundays, but he doesn't want to run a business where people who would want to go to church couldn't go to church because they're scheduled to work on Sundays. So it's interesting how organizations can make decisions to release people in ways that wouldn't impede the religious practices. But then also you have Hobby Lobby, which is a Christian organization that doesn't want to provide contraceptives, doesn't want to be mandated to provide contraceptive services to their employees because they feel that their religious practices and beliefs are being impeded and that they're being imposed upon to follow some other practices or beliefs. And so the Hobby Lobby example is a very current one and one that I think highlights some, again, the challenges within the workplace, especially if you're in charge of benefits or other human resource related programs in your organization. There's actual legal implications for the decisions that you make with regards to religion and religious beliefs. And we're going to look at a follow-up clip with regard to Hobby Lobby.
The Supreme Court recently ruled that Hobby Lobby has the right to limit what contraceptives are offered in its employees' healthcare plan. A decision that some people are calling a win for religious rights and others are calling a loss for women's rights. So what is Hobby Lobby and what did the court actually decide? Well, Hobby Lobby is an arts and crafts company based out of Oklahoma City with more than 500 locations around the U.S. It's a privately held corporation owned by devout evangelical Christians. They claim that some contraceptives offered under the Affordable Care Act are against their religious beliefs and they didn't want to be complicit in providing their employees access to these birth control measures. 5 out of 9 judges on the Supreme Court agreed with Hobby Lobby and ruled in their favor. Still, this ruling is very controversial. According to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who wrote the dissent to the Supreme Court's decision, there are tons of reasons the court should have decided against Hobby Lobby. First off, what about Hobby Lobby's female employees and their freedoms? Doesn't this decision deny these employees access to contraception? Employees who may not even share Hobby Lobby's beliefs. Plus, the government wasn't forcing Hobby Lobby to give their employees contraception, they were forcing Hobby Lobby to leave that choice up to the employees and their doctors, again, making it a personal rights issue. And what about the court's ability to stand up against other religious beliefs in future cases? Jehovah's Witnesses are against blood transfusions, Christian Scientists are against vaccinations. What's to stop business owners with those beliefs from taking away those options? According to Justice Ginsburg, we don't really know, and she thinks that all of these concerns should have been taken into greater consideration. So why didn't the court vote Ginsburg's way? Well, there are a slew of political reasons, but there is also a legitimate legal argument centering around the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It basically says that the federal government cannot substantially burden a person's exercise of religion, even if that burden was put into place as a federal law. In this case, Hobby Lobby was going to be burdened with huge fines for not following the federal laws put into place by the Affordable Care Act. The court upheld the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and Hobby Lobby won. The decision was also eased along by the fact that nonprofit organizations were already exempt from the same section of the Affordable Care Act that Hobby Lobby was refusing to follow. The ruling as written only applies to those closely held corporations, or those that have at least 50% of their stock owned by 5 or fewer individuals. And it is limited to the contraceptives in question and does not extend to those other laws or religious beliefs. Sorry, Jehovah's Witnesses, your beliefs on blood transfusions aren't going to be considered for some reason. Still, critics have questions. Why didn't the court look into the validity of Hobby Lobby's claims that the contraceptives in question were against their religious beliefs? Is the morning after pill technically abortion? Why didn't the court reopen the question of corporate personhood? If corporations can be people, can they be religious people? Why didn't they look at how this affects the rights of women? Are employers qualified to speak to issues of women's health? And should religious groups be allowed to dictate what healthcare women can and cannot have access to?
So if you were on the Supreme Court, you were asked to make the decision that was presented to them of whether to decide in favor of Hobby Lobby, of allowing them to maintain their religious convictions and not provide the contraceptives, then I would want you to come up on this side. And if you were a member of the Supreme Court and you decided that you wanted to vote against Hobby Lobby and say that this was a violation of personal rights, of individual liberties, and that Hobby Lobby should be required to provide health care in the form that it's generally offered, then I want you on that end. And before you do it, are there any, just, I know to me this is a complicated or can be somewhat confusing case. Any confusing aspects about Hobby Lobby that you want clarified? Yeah.
So was Hobby Lobby preventing their employees? Like if they were to like find out that they were using these contraceptives, were they like fired? Or were they just refusing to like pay?
Refusing to pay. So you have a healthcare benefits package, and part of the benefits package with the Affordable Care Act is that there's a list of, I'll say, prescription drugs that qualify that the company has to cover. And one of those on that list is different types of contraceptives. So the birth control pill, the morning after pill, and other things that you could then go to the doctor, get a prescription, go to the pharmacy, fill out the prescription, and get that for, you know, the copay of $5 versus the real cost of $120 or whatever it is. So Hobby Lobby was saying, you know, the owners were saying, we don't want our money to go towards paying for these contraceptives because we don't believe in them. Like we don't want to be endorsing that or supporting that because of our religious conviction. And so we want an exemption from having to cover contraceptives. So in a sense, they were saying, we're willing to provide health care benefits to all of our employees freely, but with this one caveat, this one type of health care provision we don't want to provide. Any other confusing things about it? So, okay, you're on the Supreme Court. If you're going to vote in favor of Hobby Lobby, come up here. And if you're going to vote against Hobby Lobby, back there. And there's no in-between because you're on the Supreme Court. You need to vote. Are you up here?
Yeah, I'm in the middle, but
the Supreme Court. You have to. That's the problem with the Supreme Court. You have to vote, and there's 9 of them, so you can't even have a tie, and there's always a swing vote. So the people who would be against vote against Hobby Lobby, what are the basic premises of your decision? Yeah, so mandating that Hobby Lobby pay for contraceptives.
I think it's freedom of choice. We're populated as it is anyway, so like let people control what's in their control.
So it's freedom of choice for the employee, but not the employer?
Yeah, well, I think that's what they need to respect is like it's personal choice, and I think it's almost like basic human rights, kind of, to just let them decide what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they're not preventing their employees from...
Yeah, I mean, they should provide some assistance, especially if it's just like, if it's accepted mostly in other businesses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other people who would vote against Hobby Lobby's claim, is it a women's rights issue? Is it a personal freedoms issue? Is it a public health issue? Could be an argument that, well, actually, if you provide contraceptive services, you'll have fewer kids, there'll be lower healthcare costs, and actually the company could make out. But obviously, Hobby Lobby isn't doing this for financial reasons. I don't think that's... The financial gain from it isn't great. It's more, you know, it is their religious freedom that they're trying to advocate for. It's basically saying, we just don't want to support this. I don't think it's a financial thing in that regard. For the people who would vote in favor of Hobby Lobby's claim, what are some of the reasons?
Yeah, well, I think it relates. It's basically in the same category as Chick-fil-A not being open on Sunday. I just feel like it's their choice whether they want to spend their money on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if their employees have an issue with that, then they should go to another company that will support them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say it's justified because, like, basically the company is just saying, okay, these are our religious rights. You have your own problem that's going on, and you're trying to bring your problem and affect, like, our religious, like, freedom rights. And we don't really want to deal with that. We're not saying we don't want to pay for it. You can go ahead and, like, get it yourself, but we don't want to pay for it, so I think that's justified.
Mm-hmm. So it's more that the government shouldn't require corporations to pay for certain...
Yeah, if they don't want to pay, then they don't have to, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because it's the person's problem, not the corporation's problem, necessarily.
And when you say problem, meaning...
Well, they want to take the Plan B one step because they didn't use, like, a condom during sex.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and that's sort of the larger question of the Affordable Care Act of, you know, this is just one small slice of benefits that Hobby Lobby is saying we don't want to have to cover, but there's organizations who are saying we don't want to have to be required to cover any benefits, you know, and so you could take your argument and extend it further and say, well, should the Affordable Care Act be repealed because it's mandating that organizations provide healthcare benefits? And you could say, well, that's your problem. If you get sick, I don't want to have to pay for it.
I mean, well, basically with this, it brings more of a moral question into it, where it's just like someone's actual health, like they're actually sick, they have cancer or something like that. I mean, I don't know everything the Affordable Care Act covers. Then it should be mandated, but where it's more of like a moral question, religious kind of like question, then I don't think it really should be mandated.
Mm-hmm. So that's where you would draw the line.
Yeah.
Okay, we can go back to our seats. And a handful of you asked about Title VII, which was related to discrimination and religious discrimination, but all types of discrimination based on social categories. And you asked, why is it limited to only companies with 15 or more employees? I never got a straight answer. The only thing that did show is that for companies that have smaller than 15 employees to restrict their hiring practices or different organizational practices, it'd be much more difficult to function as an organization if you had those constraints. And financially, it'd be a greater burden if you have a small number of employees and you're required to do a lot of these things that big organizations could sort of swallow the cost, but a smaller organization couldn't do it. But otherwise, I don't know why Title VII is only for organizations of 15 or more employees. So the last thing we're going to look at with religion is sort of the future of religion in the world, because you have secularization theory, which is saying that religion is going to be on the decline, or at least the submission to religious authorities, but what is sort of the trajectory of religion in the world? And I think it's very fascinating to think about where is religion going to be 50 years from now. And so here's one clip that sort of looks at current trends and trajectories to see what is religion in the world going to look like in the years to come.
This is what you need to know about the future of world religions, according to projections by the Pew Research Center, whose results are driven primarily by current differences in fertility rates and the size of youth populations around the world. The major takeaway is that by 2050, the number of Muslims around the world will nearly equal the number of Christians, as Islam will grow faster than any other major world religion, thanks to a comparatively youthful population with high fertility rates, which is projected to cause Islam's followers to grow by 73%. The number of Christians also is projected to rise, but more slowly, at about the same rate, 35%, as the global population overall. The countries on Earth with the fastest population growth rates are mostly countries with heavily Muslim populations. If these countries are able to develop faster than expected, though, their birth rates will fall, and the growth of Islam will be slower than projected here. As you can see, the current fertility rates of Muslims are significantly higher than any other religion. Muslims also have the youngest population, with 34% of their followers under the age of 15, and only 7% older than 60. Religious switching will account for over 66 million Christians changing faiths, with 93% becoming unaffiliated. Here in the United States, while declining in overall share, Christians are projected to still be the dominant religious group, although the unaffiliated, which includes agnostics and atheists, will see a large jump. Even though the number of religiously unaffiliated people will increase by nearly 10% over the next 3.5 decades, its share of the global population will actually slip by more than 3%. Today, only 60% of the world uses the internet, but as that number climbs, the number of unaffiliated, agnostic, and atheists should likely rise with it, faster than projected in this study. These are the countries projected to no longer have a Christian majority in 2050, either because the number of Christians will drop below 50% of the population, or because another group, like the unaffiliated or Muslims, will take Christianity's place as the majority religion. Under these projections, worldwide, the proportion of Muslims will surpass Christians around the year 2070. And lastly, a word of caution about this report from the Pew Research Center itself. The projections are what will occur if the current data are accurate and current trends continue. But many events, scientific discoveries, armed conflicts, social movements, political upheavals, natural disasters, and changing economic conditions, just to name a few, can shift demographic trends in unforeseen ways.
What I find most interesting about this is that you see the rise of different religions around the world or in the U.S., and one in particular that I've seen or know about is the rise of, or the increase in conservative Christians and the decrease in what would be called liberal Protestant or progressive Protestants. Their numbers are declining rapidly. And one perspective is that, oh, it's because evangelicals or conservative Christians do proselytizing and they share their faith, and so then people are converting to the faith, whereas liberal Protestants do less of that, and so then they're not growing as much. But another argument, which seems to be actually more valid, is one related to fertility. So conservative Christians have higher fertility rates, they have more kids. And so if over time conservative Christian families have more kids, then they're going to increase in population, whereas if you're a liberal Protestant, you have fewer kids, and so you're not even replacing yourself. And so a lot of the growth, and this was true with even in Islam, that the growth is driven not necessarily by conversion, but by fertility and birth rates within the religion. And one of you asked, like, well, why do so many people in the U.S. choose Christianity? Why is Christianity the dominant religion? And I would say, you know, if you come from a Christian faith tradition, it's because of the family that you were raised in, not necessarily because of your personal choice. So if you were born in a country, a Muslim country, I'd bet a lot of money on the fact that you'd probably be a Muslim, just because of your social position and where you were raised. Now, right now, as in college, you have the opportunity to sort of say, is this what I want my religion to be? And I think in many ways I get sometimes can be frustrating when people just sort of blindly select a religion on a survey. And I would always want, well, if you truly believe that religion, then self-identify with that. But if not, just say no affiliation. Because then that will actually sort of clear up what is reality, what is the social reality of what is people's, what is the proportion of faith traditions, not only at IU, but around the world. And so, like, for me, where what I found most interesting, where I actually grew in my faith the most, was when I went out to Berkeley, California, which was a place where religion thrives. It's a very secular environment, but I think why it was compelling for me was that the people who were faith-oriented were devout in their faith and explicit about it, and those who were not didn't claim, it wasn't sort of culturally beneficial or socially beneficial to identify as being a Christian or a person of faith, and so they stopped identifying that. Whereas if you go to some places in the South, everyone's Christian, and so there's no distinguishing mark. And I found it just very helpful or interesting to be in an environment where people were more authentic about this is who I am and this is what I believe, and they were not ashamed. Like, sometimes there's a stigma in certain cultures to identify as being atheist or to identify as being unaffiliated, and so the person just casually still self-identifies as being of some Christian tradition, when in reality their own personal beliefs don't reflect much of the Christian tradition. And so we talk about religiosity and religion in the workplace, and I think on a personal level it's helpful, especially at this stage of your lives, to say, what am I? What are my beliefs? And am I just sort of holding on to vestiges of growing up, or do I want to make an adult decision of, okay, this is my religious tradition, or maybe I don't know what the other religions are, so before I make a decision, I'm going to explore those so I can rule out other religions before I sort of firmly select my religion. So then when you have discussions about religion, they're more informed about, okay, yeah, this is why I believe what I believe. So that's religion in the workplace.